Hi, I'm Laura, and I think that you already answered his question in a way. You talk about struggle, and it's always the oppressed group that has to struggle to change anything. If the man you met in the train or any of the other people that you meet, your union friends, whatever, express certain views, as they feel a certain comfort level, they feel a certain support around them. And Ronald Reagan could start his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, because there was, you know, it's like pushing a big rock uphill. People just get tired of that pushing, and so the weight falls back down. And Ronald Reagan's weight, he had numbers and attitudes and years on his side that he could let the rock fall down. And it's not fair that it's the oppressed people that bear the burden of changing everybody else, but that's just how it is. I'm a regular human being. I'm very lazy. I'm very comfortable in my attitudes. I can go even further than you. I'm among liberal people. In the 70s, there was a group of people in the East Coast who were going to Cuba, and they were interviewing candidates. And a couple of my girlfriends, white girlfriends, went to interview, and they asked, one of the questions that were asked to them is, how can we make this group less racist? And they suggested, we'll have more black people come. And the people who were organizing it thought that was ridiculous. You know, that's not a good answer. That's not about race. It's about class, blah, blah, blah. It's just, it's always, you know, it's like, if you want to know the answer, don't ask a lot of other white people what the answer is. Look to the oppressed people to tell you what direction to take, what are the questions to ask, what are the problems. And it's very hard to do that because I'm very comfortable where I am. I don't want to have to change that much. And I've got a lot of support. I've got that big rock falling back down the hill that other people have to push up. And they're already behind the eight ball, I'm mixing my metaphors. But it's hard to do. It's hard to change attitudes when you're struggling to make ends meet and everything else. But that's the way it is.
In response to the whole psychology and such, for about the last year, I've been working with homeless folks, and there is a disproportionate number of African Americans that are homeless. Then something like 50 to 60% of the homeless population are black. And there's stuff coming out from the universities about the psychology of this, that basically of a trauma that was created during the slave days that is passed on generation after generation that causes this kind of situation. The similarity, I would believe, would be the same thing of the white supremacy being passed on from generation to generation as a cultural, psychological conditioning that people grow up with in their particular training. It's perpetuated by the ruling groups because it is a way of keeping people from uniting. I mean, one of the things Zen pointed out was the horror that the slave owners had when they would find whites and blacks cooperating, say, in a rebellion or any kind of resistance to the whole system. But it's something that the hatred and things of that nature is so ingrained in the culture and is so used by the culture, and it is passed on from generation to generation. This as a more submissive type of a poverty level conditions that some people find themselves in is passed on from one generation to the next generation. And it deals both, you know, economically, which ingrains into the psychology of individuals. So you do have a situation such as you have among the homeless folks. And it's similar to the Vietnam post-stress syndrome. And it is something that lasts generation after generation. And it is used basically to keep people divided and to make this kind of conditioning continue on.
Just a brief comment. You're working in Venice, in Santa Monica. The LA Times and the Santa Monica paper ran the long stories on the recent count of the homeless in LA County, and that their figures were that blacks were certainly disproportionately represented among the homeless population, approximately 39%. In L.A. County, and black African Americans represent 9% of the population, so more than four times their number. The passing on from generation to generation is done, though, in a very specific way, because we're talking about, again, a relationship of domination and subordination, never complete because the subordinates, the oppressed, have always resisted in history. the Irish in Africa, in Asia, in the Middle East, in the U.S., whatever, in virtually everything we can look at. But what I mean by specific is that, for example, in that period, in that short period of Reconstruction, the first time in the history of the United States in which African Americans actually had some political power in the southern United States, a period in history, by the way, that I would argue that if every one of us were to go back to our high schools and go to the textbooks that we learned about the carpetbaggers and the scallywags, and we learned about all the corruption, and blacks took power, and they had parties in the South Carolina legislature, and they didn't do anything, and they stole money, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Eric Foner and W.E.B. Du Bois, who are probably the two foremost historians in this country on Reconstruction, blow those myths to smithereens. When blacks had some power in the South, they did not replicate the domination against white people that white people had done to them. That was the first period in Southern history in which there was public education. That's the first period in which they opened the franchise to poor whites. That's the first time a whole bunch of reforms that emerged in the U.S. history in the South emerged in those areas in which blacks had some influence with some progressive whites, of course, who then were targeted as well in the South. And the whole counter-revolution against the Reconstruction period, which begins probably with the Compromise of 1877, the election, supposedly another stolen election. And a number of historians argue that this period post-1960s, especially beginning with Reagan, is a similar period. It can't be the same. I mean, you cannot have marauding KKKers running rampant in the southern United States as you had in the 1870s and 80s and 90s. That simply cannot happen. Not that it might never happen, but it can't happen in this period. And so those reforms, which made life better for working people and farmers in the South, were pushed by the group that was oppressed, that didn't pass on the hatred, because it is not hardwired. And we know that when we see young children, that, you know, unless people are willing to argue that racism, remember, it's a very specific phenomenon, that unless we're willing to argue that it is hardwired, a number of people argue that we, you know, like the song from South Pacific, we have to be taught to hate. You watch young children, they might struggle over a toy or something, but there's no conception when you watch little white and black kids, Asian American kids together at very young ages. There is no conception of racial supremacy or domination and subordination. There simply is not, that is not there. It has to be learned. So, of course, it goes back, and if it gets ingrained deeply in us, it becomes, it's like this, you know, the Star Trek shield. I mean, nothing can get inside of that. I know that I'm superior, you're not. You can't get inside no matter, and my God, you know, religion, we haven't touched on that. We talked about that with Columbus. You cannot understand racism in this society without understanding the whole development of religion, especially Christianity. That's an issue. That's, quote unquote, the white elephant in the room that a lot of people don't want to discuss. And we do have ample historical evidence of whites in the South. I mean, can you think of a poorer area in the United States than Appalachia? I mean, people could trace their roots to the Mayflower, okay? The biggest export for decades in Appalachia was people. An incredibly oppressed area, poverty struggles, unions and other workers in coal mines in Kentucky and Tennessee and Alabama, and yet, again, using poor whites, dividing poor whites from poor blacks, because the whites were not black, no matter how poor they were, and every single time in U.S. history when blacks and whites have come together, as in the populist movement in the South, people in power have done everything they could to divide it and crush that, because they know, and I guess this is a kind of fear, they do know that if, here, just thinking of the black-white dichotomy, okay, it's greater. Racism is, you know, you study the history of Chinese in this state, in the United States, and Japanese, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, especially in New York and the East, the Dominicans, whatever, the racism is incredible, that if all those people come together with Euro-Americans and people realize that, yeah, there are differences, but in terms of the fundamentals of life for safety and raising kids and having clean water and air and all of these things, that people have far more in common than differences, then the people who run the society are gone in a week, okay? If my ex-brother-in-law, who was a Teamster, worked hard and really understood that, you know, it was his labor that was enriching other people, if he could get rid of racism that, I mean, used to take my breath away, and he allied with people like him, he's solidly middle class, good Teamster's contract, good pension, Coast Guard too, if he got together with others who were not white like him, it'd be all over. It'd be all over. And you have to divide people. And you have to divide gay people and straight people. You know, and there, as I said, there are real differences in life. But the real differences are not as important as the real commonalities that we share as human beings on an earth with the earth. And once we see that, then we'll somehow... But to go back to what Hartley said, somehow then how do we sort of expel the poison that we've all had to ingest? And we didn't choose to ingest that, going back to kids. We don't choose our families. We don't choose to be born in a family who, let's say, my father's in the Klan, I'm born in Mississippi or Alabama, or he's a northern racist, or my mother. We don't choose that. So somehow we learn the poison, and somehow we have to expel it.
You have been listening to the question and answer session from Dr. John Marciano's June 21, 2005, discussion of Chapters 2 and 9 of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States.
We'll return to this class series in future episodes of Unwelcome Guests. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WCKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica.us or WMRW Warren.
What if you were born there and you knew how things used to be? Watching your father come home each day from the factory. What if you'd seen the ships come in, thought it might always be that way? What if you watched that all disappear and you awoke one day? What if you knew where your landlord lived on the other side of the river? In the resort town where you clean the floors, would you feel your lips quiver? What if it was your brother who had the nerve to date a white man's daughter? What if you found him with rope marks on his neck, lying in the prison for 10 years of your life for the crime of being black and poor? What if every time opportunity knocked, it was a policeman at your door? What if no one you knew had ever been to college, but everyone had been to jail? What if you knew those drugs were planted by the cops? Could you feel the cold steel rail? What if it was yesterday you were there and you saw the high-speed chase? And you watched the cop car him, saw him fall, saw the look upon his face. What if you were a witness and you watched the cops kick him in the head? What if he was your friend and you knew him well, and you watched him lying dead?
The following program by the LA Sound Posse is Professor Eric Foner's lecture titled The Meaning of Freedom in American History. It was recorded on November 4th of 2005 at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. Eric Foner is DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University.
I want to begin tonight by talking about just a single episode in the history of the idea of freedom in the United States. This was kind of an event or an institution called the Freedom Train, which was a train that traveled around the country in 1947 and 48, a little over half a century ago, carrying 133 cherished documents of American history. The Mayflower Compact, the Declaration of Independence, the Gettysburg Address, and things like that. Never before or since have so many cherished pieces of Americana been brought together in one place. The idea for the Freedom Train originated right after World War II in 1946 with the Justice Department, and it was endorsed by President Harry Truman as a way of contrasting American freedom with what he called the destruction of liberty by the Hitler tyranny. Since direct government funding seemed to smack of propaganda, the project was turned over to a nonprofit foundation called the American Heritage Foundation, whose board of trustees was composed mostly of prominent businessmen, bankers, etc. The Freedom Train was an enormous success. It attracted millions of visitors, and many more took part in public forums and parades that accompanied its journey. It went to about 300 American cities over the course of a year and a half. The powerful response to the Freedom Train, wrote one magazine, revealed a deep popular hunger for evidence of American freedom. But behind the scenes, the Freedom Train demonstrated that the actual meaning of this idea of freedom was not uncontroversial. Because how do you choose which pieces of American history exemplify this idea of freedom? The original list had been drawn up by staff members at the National Archives, and these were liberal New Dealers. They had included initially the Wagner Act of 1935, which was the first law to give workers the legal right to form unions, collective bargaining. They included President Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech of 1941, which outlined the Allied war aims in World War II. You may remember the Four Freedoms were freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from fear, and freedom from want. But the prominent businessmen of the American Heritage Foundation thought that the fourth, freedom from want, sounded vaguely socialistic. So they eliminated the Four Freedoms speech from the Freedom Train. Also taken off the Freedom Train from the initial list were the 14th and 15th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution, which had guaranteed the civil and political rights of African Americans right after the Civil War. In the end, nothing on the Freedom Train referred to organized labor. The Wagner Act was also taken off, or any social legislation. And of the 133 documents, only three made any reference to black Americans. And in fact, African Americans were initially quite skeptical about the Freedom Train. On the eve of the train's unveiling, the black poet Langston Hughes wrote a poem in which he wondered, "Will there be Jim Crow, that is segregation, on the Freedom Train? When it stops in Mississippi," he wrote, "will it be made plain everybody's got a right to board the Freedom Train?" In fact, with the Truman administration about to make civil rights a major issue in the 1948 presidential election, the train's organizers announced that they would not permit segregated viewing. In an unprecedented move, the American Heritage Foundation actually canceled visits of the Freedom Train to Memphis, Tennessee, and Birmingham, Alabama, because the city fathers there insisted that black and white visitors could not go on the train at the same time. The Freedom Train did visit something like 45 other southern cities in an integrated fashion without incident, and in the end it was hailed in the black press for breaching, at least temporarily, the walls of segregation. So the Freedom Train reflected a growing sense of national unease after World War II with expressions of racial inequality. As it journeyed along, it also began to reveal the impact of the Cold War on ideas about freedom. As I said, the Freedom Train was initially launched to emphasize the contrast between American freedom and Nazism. But in 1947, a few months before the Freedom Train was unveiled, the Cold War began. President Truman announced the Truman Doctrine, committing the United States to the worldwide containment of communism, and also the Internal Security Program, whereby government employees were brought before little commissions to prove their loyalty. Soon, the Attorney General, Tom Clark, was hailing the Freedom Train as a means of preventing what he called foreign ideologies from infiltrating the United States and aiding the country in, this is a quote, its war against subversive elements. The FBI began compiling reports about people who criticized the Freedom Train or seemed to be unenthusiastic about it. The Freedom Train inaugurated a period, the 1950s, when the language of freedom suffused American culture. This was the period of the free world battling against the communist world. But it also revealed how the Cold War was subtly reshaping freedom's meaning, identifying it more and more with anti-communism, what was called free enterprise, which replaced freedom from want as the economic definition of freedom, and generally the defense of the social and economic status quo. Now, I begin with this little incident of the Freedom Train because it reveals in microcosm the major point, really, I want to make tonight, which is that far from being fixed, the definition of freedom is the subject of persistent conflict and debate in American history. And that story also points to the three issues or themes that I think these debates about freedom have revolved around. One is what you might call the meaning of freedom. And what is your definition? What do you think freedom is? The second is what you might call the social conditions of freedom. Whatever you think freedom is, what kind of social arrangements are necessary in order to enable people to enjoy freedom? And the third is the boundaries of freedom. Whatever you think freedom is, who is entitled to enjoy it and who is not? And why aren't those people who are entitled to freedom allowed to have it? Now, I'm sure you'll agree that no idea is more fundamental to our sense of ourselves as Americans than freedom. This is the central word in our political vocabulary, along with liberty, with which it's usually used interchangeably. The Declaration of Independence lists liberty as one of the inalienable rights of man. The Constitution begins by saying that its purpose is to secure the blessings of liberty. Freedom has often been used as a rallying cry to generate public support in wartime. President Lincoln said the Civil War was being fought to bring about a new birth of freedom. World War II, as I said, was fought for the four freedoms. The Cold War was fought to defend the free world. And the current war in Iraq, as you know, has been given the title Operation Iraqi Freedom. Americans' love of freedom has been represented by liberty poles, liberty caps, and statues of liberty. It's been acted out by burning stamps and burning draft cards, by running away from slavery, and by demonstrating for the right to vote. Obviously, other peoples also cherish freedom. We're not the only country in the world that desires freedom. But the idea does seem to occupy a more prominent place in our public and private discourse than in many other places. The ubiquitous American excuse employed by disobedient children and antisocial adults, quote, it's a free country, sort of an excuse for anything, is not familiar in most other societies. Every man in the street, white, black, red, or yellow, wrote the educator Ralph Bunche in 1940, every man in the street, white, black, red, or yellow, knows that this is the land of the free and the cradle of liberty. And as groups from the abolitionists to modern-day conservatives have realized, to capture, you might say, the word freedom is to acquire a formidable position of strength in political debates. But perhaps because of its very ubiquity or commonality, the history of this idea of freedom is a story, as I said, of debates and disagreements and struggles, rather than a set of timeless categories or a evolutionary narrative toward a fixed goal. And the meaning, the changing meaning of freedom, has been constructed and reconstructed at all levels of society, not only in Supreme Court decisions and congressional debates, but on slave plantations and labor picket lines, and even in people's parlors and bedrooms. Now, if freedom has been a battleground throughout our history, so also has been what I call the boundaries of freedom, the definition of who's entitled to enjoy it. We all know today that the United States was founded as a nation on the premise that liberty is the right of all mankind, but at the same time, it deprived many of its own people at that time of freedom. Efforts to limit freedom along one or another line of social existence have occurred throughout our history. That's fairly obvious. More to the point, or more interesting perhaps, is that freedom is often defined by its limits. Before the Civil War, slave owners insisted that slavery was the best foundation for freedom, that the free person was the person who was autonomous, who did not have to labor, who was not dependent for his livelihood on someone else. Owning slaves made you independent, made you a truly free person. Similarly, the autonomy or independence of men, the lone pioneer, the lone individual out in the marketplace, has often rested on the subordination of women. The independent man often has women and children dependent on him and keeping his household in order for him. Their dependence helps to define his freedom. And for this reason, it's often through what you might call battles at the boundaries of freedom, that is, the efforts of racial minorities, of women, of others, to gain freedom as they understand it, that the meaning of this idea has changed and been deepened. Time and again in our history, the definition of freedom has been transformed by the demands of excluded groups for inclusion. Now, so far, what I've been saying is pretty abstract in general. What I want to do for the remainder of my time is look at a couple of key moments in American history. And I want to look at a few moments in the changing definition of freedom and then talk about what has happened to this idea of freedom in the last 4 years since the terrible events of September 11th, 2001. And I'm going to talk mostly about the 20th century. But, of course, Americans in the 20th century were the inheritors of ideas of freedom that went much deeper back in American history. The American Revolution gave birth to an idea about American nationhood and national mission that persists to this day. The founding generation saw the new nation as a unique embodiment of liberty in a world overrun by oppression. That's what Tom Paine said in Common Sense, that great pamphlet arguing for American independence. This was going to be the asylum for liberty for the world. People seeking liberty could come to America to find it from places that lacked it. This is why Thomas Jefferson could call the United States an empire of liberty. Now, in some ways, that term seems to be contradictory. An empire means domination. It means rule over others. But Jefferson said our empire was going to be different from European empires. They were oppressive. Our empire meant the spread of liberty. So the spread of American power, ipso facto, meant the expansion of freedom. This idea of America as an example to the world, of the superiority of free institutions, as you all know, remains alive and well today in our political culture. But as I said, the Revolution also revealed the inner contradiction of American freedom by giving birth to a nation committed to liberty, but resting in large measure on slavery. And freedom is an idea that often is relational. What I mean is, people's ideas of freedom often seem to be defined by some notion of unfreedom or lack of freedom. Sometimes that is identified abroad, like Nazism or Soviet communism. In the 19th century, the definition of unfreedom was here at home. It was chattel slavery. And slavery had a powerful effect on American definitions of freedom. On the one hand, it limited freedom by race. On the eve of the Civil War, in the Dred Scott decision, the Supreme Court declared that no black person could be a citizen of the United States. American freedom was only for white people. The power of slavery created that boundary, that racial boundary around enjoyment of the right to enjoy freedom. But at the same time, the struggle of abolitionists, of slaves themselves, for freedom as they understood it, reinvigorated the notion of freedom as a universal right, not something limited by whiteness. The principles of equality before the law, of birthright citizenship, that anybody born in this country, regardless of race, should be an equal citizen of the United States, those ideas originated in the struggle against slavery. They were written into our laws and Constitution after the Civil War, during the period we call Reconstruction. The abolition of slavery in the Civil War reinvigorated this notion of America as a land of freedom, which had been somewhat tarnished by the existence of 4 million slaves before the war. And by the 1880s, the British visitor James Bryce, who wrote a famous book about the United States, was struck by, as he said, the power not only of Americans' commitment to freedom, but their conviction, as he wrote, that they were the only people truly to enjoy it, this sense of American uniqueness in enjoyment of freedom. Now, I'm mostly going to talk about the 20th century. At the turn of the century, what I have referred to as the social conditions of freedom, or what you might simply say as economic freedom, was the major point of debate about what is freedom. And to oversimplify considerably, there were two basic ideas about what are the conditions of life that enable people to be free. One was the social Darwinist view or the laissez-faire view that true freedom exists in the right to compete in the marketplace, that the ability to pursue your own interest, to pursue your own livelihood in a free market without any outside restraint or regulation was the genuine definition of freedom. Critics, however, on the other side, the populists, the labor movement, later the progressive movement, raised the question of whether freedom could really exist in conditions of extreme economic inequality. In the 19th century, economic freedom had generally been defined as independence. I mentioned that. Owning your own farm, owning a shop, not being economically dependent on someone else. But in the industrial age, this no longer applied. Owning a little shop was not the way to really get ahead in a society of large factories, etc. What did industrial freedom, as people talked about it at the turn of the century, what did it mean in a modern society? The critics of this laissez-faire view of freedom said that in a modern economy, economic freedom meant economic security. Sometimes it was called a living wage. Sometimes it was called an American standard of living. But to secure economic freedom defined that way required not government stepping aside from the market, but active intervention of government to uplift those at the bottom of society. Jumping ahead, this idea of freedom as economic security reached its high point in a way during the New Deal of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Roosevelt, as you may know, was the first president to use modern technology, the radio at that time, to bring his views directly into the homes of American citizens through his famous fireside chats. And one of the things he tried to do from the very beginning of his administration was to attach the notion of freedom to the New Deal. In his second fireside chat, Roosevelt juxtaposed his definition of freedom as what he called greater security for the average man with the older notion of freedom as just free competition. And he said that just served the interests of what he called the privileged few. Roosevelt consistently linked freedom with economic security. The liberty of a democracy, he declared, was not safe if citizens were unable to sustain an acceptable standard of living. So Roosevelt invoked liberty or freedom to sustain the New Deal, but his critics in the 1930s also made liberty their fighting slogan. The principal conservative critique of the New Deal was that it limited American freedom by making the government too powerful. When conservative businessmen and politicians in 1934 formed an organization to oppose the New Deal, they called it the American Liberty League. In fact, in 1936, the New York Times wrote of that presidential election that the fight, this is a quote, the fight for possession of the ideal of freedom was the central issue of that campaign. Which idea of freedom was going to triumph, Roosevelt's or his opponents? Roosevelt won, of course, in 1936, but the conservative opposition planted the seeds for a later flowering of anti-statist conservatism, which we see as, of course, very powerful today. Now, often our ideas of freedom are defined in relation to some other example of lack of freedom. In the 19th century, that was slavery. In the 20th century, we have tended to identify unfreedom or threats to freedom abroad. And the point is that these encounters with these foreign examples of lack of freedom have subtly affected the meaning of freedom in the United States. One example of that is the struggle against Nazi Germany, which both it highlighted aspects of American freedom that had previously been neglected, and it also began the process of changing the boundaries of American freedom. Today, if you ask your man or woman in the street to define freedom, they will pretty soon mention the privileges enumerated in the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press, etc. And these were, of course, written into the Constitution in 1791. But for many, many years, many decades, even though those rights were in the Constitution, there was no jurisprudence. There were no legal defenses, really, of freedom of expression, freedom of dissent. At many points in our history, in the 19th and 20th century, there was legal and extra-legal repression of dissenters, of labor organizers, of socialists in World War I, advocates of birth control who were arrested. Many others had found that freedom of expression was limited in American society. It wasn't until the 1930s that the defense of civil liberties began to assume a central place in mainstream definitions of American freedom. And there were many causes for this development, but one was the ideological revulsion, as I say, against Nazism, and the invocation of freedom as a shorthand way of describing the differences between American society and Nazi Germany. As I said, Roosevelt included freedom of speech and freedom of religion, both from the First Amendment, in his four freedoms that were the purpose of World War II. And during World War II, the Nazi counterexample was frequently cited by defenders of civil liberty in the United States. For example, in a famous case when the Supreme Court reversed a previous decision and allowed members of the Jehovah's Witnesses group, well, this was about children from Jehovah's Witnesses families who refused to take the Pledge of Allegiance in school because taking an oath was against their religion, and they were disciplined in school. At first, the Supreme Court had ruled that's too bad, they got to do it, you know, the school has a right to discipline them. In 1943, the Supreme Court reversed itself and said, no, they have the right to dissent. And that's the difference, the court said, between us and Nazi Germany. In Nazi Germany, people do not have the right to express their view or to remain silent against the state, but in the United States, we do. And so that's just one example of how this Nazi counterexample elevated the importance of freedom of speech as a central element of American conceptions of freedom. World War II also helped to reshape debates about the boundaries of American freedom. You may remember that in World War I, the federal government, the Wilson administration, had conducted a vigorous campaign against what they called hyphenated Americanism. That is, they insisted that immigrant groups must prove their loyalty to the nation by Americanizing themselves, by surrendering their old world cultures. You could not be an Italian American or a German American. You had to be an American by entering the great melting pot and sloughing off your old world culture and loyalties. In World War II, the government took exactly the opposite position. The official position of the government was pluralism. What made America distinct was that all groups could enjoy equality and freedom without surrendering their cultures and their identities. The government used the mass media, radio, motion pictures to promote a narrative of American history based on the contribution of all the immigrant groups, and indeed black Americans, to the development of American society. And again, it was the contrast with the theory of a master race, the Nazi race theory, that set the United States in some ways on this road to a more pluralistic vision of American freedom. Racism was the enemy's philosophy. Americanism meant tolerance and equality for all. Now, of course, this ideal was not entirely abided by in World War II. Japanese Americans were deprived of most of their rights as citizens by being interned in camps. The country remained deeply racially segregated. The army was still segregated. But World War II certainly brought a heightened awareness of the contradiction between racial inequality in America and the rhetoric of American freedom. And in fact, my view is it's World War II that launched the modern civil rights movement. We just saw the death of Rosa Parks the last few days, who was certainly a figure worth remembering. But, you know, you don't believe what you see on TV. I guess that's the first point any intelligent person ought to remember. Rosa Parks did not begin the civil rights movement in 1955 when she refused to give up her seat in a bus. There was a long history before that. And the modern civil rights movement, I think, comes out of World War II and the struggles that it unleashed. Anyway, the Cold War, which followed World War II, in some ways was rhetorically a continuation of the Second World War, with communism taking the place of Nazism as the external example of lack of freedom. Once again, the United States was the leader of a global crusade for freedom against its enemy. As the Soviets replaced Germany as the opposite of freedom, as I said before, freedom from want, that is to say, the right of everybody to at least some basic standard of living, slipped into the background because it seemed too akin to socialist ideas. In its place came free enterprise, or in another way of putting it, consumer freedom. That is, freedom meant the ability to choose from the cornucopia of goods produced by the modern American economy. And the high or low point of this equation of freedom with consumerism came at a famous moment of Cold War history in 1959 that is known to historians as the Kitchen Debate. In 1959, in a thaw in the Cold War, the United States and the Russians exchanged national expositions. The Soviets opened an exposition in New York, which featured the products of heavy industry, you know, steel and stuff like this, to show how they had progressed economically. The American exposition in Moscow, which was opened by Vice President Richard Nixon, was an exhibition of consumer goods, cars, TV sets, stereo sets, and the centerpiece was a model of a suburban kitchen with all these labor-saving devices, dishwashing machine, refrigerators, even a little automated floor sweeper. And Nixon opened the exhibition with a speech entitled, What Freedom Means to Us. But instead of focusing on political rights, democracy, freedom of speech, he focused on consumerism. He said, what does freedom mean to us? We've got 56 million cars in the United States. You know, we got 72 million TV sets. You can buy a refrigerator in any color, white, green, mauve. You know, that's freedom. And then as Nixon and Khrushchev, the Soviet prime minister, sort of toured this exhibit, they came to that kitchen and they had this unscripted, impromptu debate. And it was left to Khrushchev, the representative supposedly of a materialist society, to say, surely there must be more to freedom than just accumulating a lot of stuff, you know? And also, the 1950s idea of freedom with that kitchen of a suburban home assumed a certain role for women in the American society as basically the suburban housewife. In fact, during the debate, Nixon pointed to the little robot that was sweeping the floor and said, in the United States, you're so free that you don't even need a wife. So the glorification of freedom as the essential characteristic of the United States in this global combat with its enemy opened the door for others to seize upon the idea of freedom for very other purposes. And of course, the most striking was the civil rights movement, or as it called itself, the freedom movement, with its freedom rides and freedom songs and freedom marches and its insistent cry, freedom now. And the civil rights movement took the idea of freedom, which had become a kind of a shibboleth, a slogan of government without a heck of a lot of deep meaning in the 1950s, and reinvigorated it as the rallying cry of the dispossessed. When Martin Luther King Jr. ended his great oration on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in 1963, he ended that speech, the I Have a Dream speech, with a cry from a spiritual, a black spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. He was not referring to just getting the government off your back, or owning a gun, or not paying taxes, which is what a lot of people think freedom is today. Freedom for the movement meant empowerment, dignity, equality, recognition for a people that had so long been deprived of their rights. Freedom for the black movement was a process. It was an open-ended struggle. It was something to aim for in the future, not something that you are born with and can sort of take for granted. And, of course, the black movement strongly influenced the other social movements of the 60s, which all picked up this language of freedom or liberation. And the 1960s sort of pioneered a key transition or transformation in the idea of freedom by pushing it into the most private realms of life, private self-determination. The feminist movement of the 1960s, the so-called new wave of feminism, insisted that there were issues of rights, of equality, of inequality, of freedom and lack of freedom, even in marriage, even in sexual relations, in the most personal of relations, there were issues of people lacking freedom. And even though the political impulse of the 1960s has faded, this idea of freedom as not only the right to choose in the consumer marketplace, but in private matters, is still very prominent in our society today. I think most people think about freedom in some ways as choosing, not a term I like, but one hears a lot, choosing your lifestyle, the right to wear what clothing you want, to wear your hair the way you want, to follow your sexual orientation, whatever it may be. And that's an expansion of the idea of freedom. It's certainly not what the founding fathers have in mind. When Jefferson talked about the United States as an empire of liberty, that wasn't what he was talking about. But it's an example of how the idea of freedom changes and grows and moves into areas that perhaps it wasn't originally intended for. But of course, after the 60s, there was another turn. President Reagan in the 80s, like Roosevelt 50 years before, was a master of communication, of language. And he reappropriated freedom for his more conservative message of free market economics, lack of government regulation. In a way, we still are living, at least in the 1990s, we're still living in the wake of the Reagan Revolution, as they call it. The dominant definitions of freedom nowadays seem to be negations of government, of the notion of a common public culture, negation of individual, you know, any restraint on individual self-determination. In the late 90s, when I was writing a book about all this, I searched the internet one day for sites connected with freedom, and I came up with mostly groups that didn't want to pay taxes, were defending the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms, armed militia groups, groups promoting the sanctity of private property, free trade, etc. There wasn't any site promoting the virtues of big government, for example, as an element of freedom. At the same time, in the 1990s, the collapse of communism led to an unprecedented worldwide expansion of American ideas and internationalization of American ideas about freedom. The free world triumphed over its adversary, the free market over the idea of a planned or regulated economy, and the free individual over the idea of a collective social responsibility. And American ideas of freedom reverberated throughout the world, promoted by a consumer culture and the economic marketplace. Well, in the aftermath of the terrorist attack of September 11th, the language of freedom again took center stage in American public discourse, where it remains to this day. It quickly became the sort of all-purpose explanation for both the attack and the ensuing war against terrorism. Freedom itself is under attack, said President Bush in his speech to Congress 10 days after September 11th. Our antagonists, he said, hate our freedoms, our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, our freedom to assemble. In 2002, in a speech, the one I'm quoting, he said, he asked, why did Bin Laden attack America? The answer, quote, because we love freedom and they hate freedom. And then later in 2002, in calling for increased attention to the teaching of American history, President Bush said, we need to teach American history so that school children can understand that ours is a history of freedom, freedom for everybody. And also in 2002, the government issued a very important document called the National Security Strategy, which is actually on the White House website, well worth taking a look at. This is the document that announced the doctrine of preemptive war, which then led to the war in Iraq in 2003. The National Security Strategy is about international politics and everything, but what's interesting is the beginning of it. It opens not with a discussion of weaponry or geopolitics, but with a discussion of freedom. In fact, it defines freedom. It says, here is what freedom is. Freedom is political democracy, freedom of expression, religious toleration, and free enterprise. These, it says, quote, are right and true for every person in every society. There is no sense, and this is deeply rooted in American history, that other people might have thought about the question of freedom and might have come to their own conclusions. We know what freedom is, and our idea of freedom is right and true for every other person in the world. That's what the National Security Strategy said. It also said that there is, quote, a single sustainable model of society that encourages freedom. That is the United States. There is only one possible model of society that enjoys freedom. It's worth stopping for a moment to reflect on this language, the single sustainable model. The idea of a single model is profoundly illiberal, and I mean illiberal not in the sense of liberal versus conservative, but in the philosophical sense popularized by Sir Isaiah Berlin, a British writer on liberty, who says a liberal society is one in which different models compete for acceptance. In fact, it's totalitarian to say there's only one model of society that can exist. And sustainable, a single sustainable model, what would happen if the entire world actually adopted the American model and consumed energy and emitted carbon dioxide into the atmosphere at the same rate as the United States? How sustainable would life on Earth be in that circumstance? But of course, as during the Cold War, the invocation of freedom has proved to be a very popular rallying cry, even as it sort of subsumes the whole world into an either-or dichotomy. You're either, as the president said, you're either for us or against us. You're either for freedom or against freedom. And as has happened at other times in our history, the current war against terror, the war in Iraq, has also raised the question of how do you fight for freedom, or that is to say, what are the consequences for liberty at home of fighting a war defined as a war for freedom? As has happened during previous wars, we have seen serious erosions of traditional civil liberties. Legal protections like habeas corpus, the right to a trial by a jury, the right to a lawyer, the right to equality before the law, regardless of race or national origin, all these have been curtailed. In the aftermath of September 11th, several thousand people of Middle Eastern origin were arrested, many of them held without charge or without any public acknowledgement of their fate for a considerable period of time. The government has argued in court that even American citizens can be held indefinitely in jail without a charge if the president designates them an enemy combatant. This is a violation of legal traditions that go back to Magna Carta, the idea that you can't just chuck someone in jail and throw away the key. You've got to have a charge, you've got to let them have a lawyer, you've got to have a trial. But our government is still insisting that the president can, by his declaration, strip a person of all his constitutional rights and just keep him in jail as long as he feels like it. But what I find more interesting than that, because this has happened in many American wars, is the widespread popular acquiescence in what I think are some important violations of civil liberties. This was driven home to me, actually, last spring. I don't know if any of you have seen this, but in Washington, D.C., there's this museum called the International Spy Museum, which is a kind of strange place because part of it is history and part of it is James Bond movies and stuff. But I went there because they had an exhibit called Terror in America, 1776 to today. And I wanted to see, you know, it's interesting. Who are they listing as terrorists? And it was a kind of strange conglomeration. There was Timothy McVeigh, you know, who blew up the Oklahoma City Federal Building. There was the Ku Klux Klan. There were anarchists at some time. There was also John Brown, the abolitionist. And there was also the British who burned Washington during the War of 1812, which was sort of uncouth, but it wasn't really terrorism. It was really a war. But the interesting thing was that at this exhibit, they had computer screens where the visitors could vote on various propositions. And the one that struck me was a proposition which said, quote, "The government should have the authority to deport or indefinitely detain people suspected of supporting groups hostile to the United States." Now, let me just point that the government should have the authority to deport or indefinitely detain people not convicted of any crime, but suspected of supporting groups hostile to the United States. What does that mean? There are people who think environmentalists are hostile to the United States. In other words, the government can throw anyone in jail for any time they want if they think they don't like them. That's what the proposition is. As of last January, when I was there, 30,000 people had voted on this proposition. Now, this is not a scientific sample. It's not a Gallup poll, but it's a lot of people. And of those 30,000, 55% had voted yes, and 32% had voted no. So a majority of those 30,000 thought that, again, the government should have the right to just strip people of their basic rights if they suspected them of something. Not proved anything, just suspect, not even charged with a crime, just supporting groups. Now, again, what is the point? The point is people are afraid, and history shows that in times of fear, you might say fear trumps liberty all the time. People are willing to give up basic rights if they think their security is endangered. But I think the lesson of that is to remind us that civil liberties are not a permanent, inborn feature of our civilization, but are a rather fragile achievement, which our civilization has been won over a long period of time by many, many different groups and struggles, and they're not self-enforcing, they're not self-correcting, and they have to be guarded with great vigilance, even in times of crisis. And we should recall previous episodes in wartime, like the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, or the repression of dissent in World War I, or Japanese-American internment in World War II, to remind ourselves of the dangers of stripping people of their rights, even if it's one particular ethnic or racial group, as happened in World War II, and the dangers that that involves. As Justice Robert Jackson of the Supreme Court wrote in the Korematsu case in World War II, in which the court upheld the internment of Japanese-Americans, in his dissent, he said, "This decision lies about like a loaded weapon ready for the hand of any authority that can bring forward a plausible claim to an urgent need." In other words, we have to be nervous about governments just claiming the necessity of violating civil liberties because of dangers that might exist. But again, this notion flows automatically almost from the idea that the United States is the embodiment of freedom and that therefore whatever we do is in effect promoting freedom. And the American self-image as the sole defender of freedom in the world has been reinvigorated and promoted very vigorously as you know, by the government in the last 4 years since September 11th. But I think the idea that the United States or the West in general has an exclusive claim on liberty is a very unhistorical idea. It ignores the recency of the triumph of commitment to freedom in the West and the fact that these values, as I said, are still contested even within our own society. In other words, what I'm saying is that if we just define ourselves as the emblem of liberty and leave it at that, it makes it impossible for us to take seriously dangers to liberty at home, and it makes it also impossible for us to interpret criticism from abroad as anything but hostility to freedom, which is, I think, unfortunately, how much of our government is thinking today. Let me just finish in a minute. I will go back to the 18th century with a quote from Anthony Ashley Cooper, a key Enlightenment figure in Great Britain. In the mid-18th century, when Britain was the most powerful nation on earth, just as we are sort of today, Ashley Cooper commented on the paradox that international power seemed to go hand in hand with a kind of philosophical insularity, a hostility to ideas from abroad. Our best policy and breeding, he writes, it seems, is to look abroad as little as possible, to contract our views within the narrowest compass, to despise all knowledge or learning which is not of home growth. And more than two centuries later, September 11th seems to have produced a similar odd combination of cosmopolitanism, we know we're embedded in the world, and myopia, the demand that we once again emphasize what sets us apart from the rest of the world. Now, shortly before his death in 1970, my PhD supervisor at Columbia University, Richard Hofstadter, gave an interview with Newsweek magazine. 1970 was a pretty volatile time in American life. Hofstadter's interview was a reflection on a society confronting what he called a crisis of the spirit. He said young people had no sense of vocation, no aspirations for the future. They were alienated. But their causes of alienation, he said, well, he didn't really sympathize with the student rebels of the 60s, but he said they had real causes of alienation. He said, quote, you have a major urban crisis, you have this question of race, you have a cruel and unnecessary war, Vietnam. Ultimately, he went on, American society's conception of itself had to change. He said, I think that part of our trouble is that our sense of ourselves hasn't diminished as much as it ought to. In other words, he seemed to be saying the United States needed to accept limitations on its power to shape the entire world. Today, 25 years later, Hofstadter's call for Americans to listen to the rest of the world, not just seek to impose our will on it, seems more relevant than ever. This is difficult for a nation that has always considered itself a beacon of liberty to mankind. But there's another American tradition which is embodied in the Declaration of Independence. If you read that document, you will find that the authors wrote it in order to demonstrate what they called, quote, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind. It's not our job as historians or teachers to tell our fellow citizens what they should think about the world or about freedom. But we should try to insist that discussions of freedom ought to transcend boundaries rather than simply reinforcing or reproducing them. In the wake of September 11th, it's all the more imperative that we develop a candid appraisal of our own country's strengths and weaknesses. The dangers to freedom, not just our enjoyment of freedom, and not simply engage in self-celebration. And if September 11th makes us think more historically rather than mythically about our nation and its history, then maybe some good will have come out of that tragic event. So thank you very much for listening.
Historian Eric Foner speaking on the changing meanings of freedom in American history. The talk was given last fall at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. Thanks to the LA Sound Posse, whose recordings were used in this week's program. You can learn more about their mission to create a democratic civic media on the web at lasoundposse.org. And thanks to David Rovics for his music. More from David at davidrovics.com. And you can contact us on the web at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening. By unwelcome travelers.